Born from the tragedy of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has supported our nation's heroes and their families ever since. Heroes like Marine Corps Sergeant Adam Mayo. He served our nation for over 7 years before he was severely injured during training. He was left paralyzed from the chest down, severely limiting his ability to move around his home independently. Tunnel to Towers paid Sergeant Mayo's mortgage, removing a financial burden for him and his family. The foundation gave him a specially adapted smart home designed for his specific needs. Tunnel to Towers helps severely injured service members and first responders, as well as Gold Star families and the families of fallen first responders. It has already come to the aid of so many heroes and their families by providing mortgage-free homes. The foundation is also committed to eradicating veteran homelessness. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. 95 cents of every dollar goes directly to their programs. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T2T.org. If you are an accredited investor, U.S. oil and gas should be part of your investment portfolio. Visit LabradorEnergy.com. Beyond the possibility to invest in a sector that historically delivers sound returns, when you invest with Labrador Energy, you may be able to structure your investment to offset active or passive income. According to many sources, U.S. oil and gas drilling remains one of the best tax-advantaged income investments available. Visit LabradorEnergy.com. You may be able to reduce your tax liability while investing in a sector that has historically delivered sound returns. Learn more at LabradorEnergy.com today.
Offer for accredited investors only. Past performance is no indication of future results. Investing involves risk. Consult your legal, tax, and financial advisors and read the prospectus before making any investment decisions. Visit LabradorEnergy.com for the prospectus and more information.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the Buck Sexton Show podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Big news today. The Federal Reserve has announced it is raising its key short interest rate by 0.75% in an effort to curb out-of-control inflation, the central bank's biggest rate hike in 28 years. Also ahead, a special congressional race in the Lone Star State making some serious headlines as a deep blue Texas district has elected its first Republican in 100 years. So could this be the first indication of the coming red wave in November? We'll take a look at that and more in Hold the Line.
From the standpoint of our congressional mandate to promote maximum employment and price stability, the current picture is plain to see. The labor market is extremely tight, and inflation is much too high. Against this backdrop, today the Federal Open Market Committee raised its policy interest rate by 0.75 percentage point and anticipates that ongoing increases in that rate will be appropriate.
Welcome to Hold the Line. I'm Buck Sexton. That was Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell talking about the big interest rate hike today. This is the Fed's primary tool in the toolkit, and they are using it because inflation is really harming the economic day-to-day lives of the American people, right? Price of gas, price of food, price of everything. And your wages are certainly not keeping up with the decrease in the spending power that is currently underway. So we know that the Biden administration, with a major midterm election coming up here, is not looking good, folks. People really react poorly across the political spectrum to high gas prices and high inflation because they can't hide it, because they know it's real, because it is there and apparent for all to see and pay for day in and day out.
So on the negative side of things, yeah, the economy is going to be rough for a while. We might start hearing a lot about stagflation. We might soon be in the Biden recession. On the positive side of things, I like to look at the positive. We just had some very interesting results out of Texas's 34th congressional district. Special election was held there, and Republican Mayra Flores got 51% of the vote against Democrat Dan Sanchez. Now, Mayra Flores was born in Mexico, is the first Latina female member of Congress to come from the state of Texas. She is also the wife of a Border Patrol agent and is very pro-border security, opposed to illegal immigration, which I'm pretty sure the Democrats would tell us is so racist. So someone's going to have to tell Mexican-born Mayra Flores that it is racist for her now, as a soon-to-be-seated member of Congress, to say that our wide-open border isn't a good idea. Well, actually, here's what she said. We can hear from her personally, or specifically, during her victory speech last night. Why?
Policies that are being placed right now are hurting us. We cannot accept the increase of gas, of food, of medication. We cannot accept that. And we have to state the facts that under President Trump, we did not have this mess in this country.
Pretty straightforward. Under President Trump, we did not have that, have the mess that she was just laying out there. All true. This is just factual now, right? But now, why are we all looking at this particular congressional special election, right? There are a lot of members, hundreds of members of Congress. So why does this one seem to be such a possible indicator, maybe even a bellwether of where all of this is going? Texas has, the demographics, rather, of Texas is 34th. Show the following: Hispanic 85%, white 13%, black and other 1% each. So this is a heavily Hispanic district that is right along the U.S.-Mexico border in the Rio Grande sector, in the eastern part of Texas, southeastern part of Texas, right tucked up against the border. And one of the big issues that Mayra Flores was using in her campaign was the mess at the southern border and the way that it has become just lawless, and the cartels are flooding communities with fentanyl, and it really affects people who live along the border. The illegal migrants coming into their communities, the drain on resources, the constant law enforcement effort that's underway to deal with this. And so that's really interesting, but it also could be a sign of a broader shift among Hispanic voters nationwide. This is the hope, certainly among Republicans, that the red wave we are expecting this fall could be led by Hispanic voters who come out in big numbers for Republican candidates, many of whom may be leaving the Democrat Party in their voting this fall. And that could be enormously important. That could really make a huge difference. The polling currently suggests that that's happening. In fact, Biden is more unpopular with, and the Republicans are more popular with, the Hispanic community than any other community right now. So that's a particularly interesting data point given where we think these midterms are heading. Meanwhile, the Biden administration, while this is going on, has to figure out ways to try to placate their lunatic left-wing base and maybe get them fired up so they'll at least turn out in the blue enclaves. And that then brings me to the Fox News report on how Border Patrol agents may be disciplined who are involved in the fake horsewhipping of migrants incident, right? Remember the Haitian migrants who were part of a massive caravan, about 10 or 15,000 at the U.S.-Mexico border? And then there was this photo, and this photo then led to, these are mounted members of Border Patrol, people said in the media, Democrats, they're whipping Haitian migrants. That's not true. They are on horseback using split reins. Nobody was whipped. That's just a fact. They already did the investigation. The reporter who was on the scene, the photographer on the scene, said there was no person actually being whipped. But now it turns out, according to Fox News, the Department of Homeland Security is preparing to discipline multiple horseback Border Patrol agents involved in the infamous whipping incident of Haitian migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border back in September. The source said that DHS will be putting forth proposals to discipline the agents who will have a chance to respond. The charges, Fox News is told, are administrative violations do not amount to criminal conduct. The agents were already cleared of that. So the agents committed no crime here. But let's remember, this is all politics, friends. They might, oh, maybe some of the agents used foul language. You know, they cursed. Oh, no. So let's hit them with an administrative violation. Maybe, you know, they were a little too forceful when they said, hey, stop violating U.S. federal law by entering our country illegally. But let's remember that the Democrats are willing to throw Border Patrol agents under the bus at the first political opportunity, the moment that it suits them. And this is back in April. Then propaganda czar Jen Psaki refused to apologize to Border Patrol after they were accused of whipping migrants, which they did not do. Watch.
Additional question about something that happened a few months ago down at the border. We've been told that the mounted Border Patrol officers the president accused of whipping migrants have been notified they will not face criminal charges. So when is the president going to apologize to them?
There is a process and an investigation that's gone through the Department of Homeland Security. I don't have any update on that.
The president said that they were whipping people, which would be a criminal offense, and they've been told they're not going to be criminally charged.
And there was an investigation into that, and I'll let the Department of Homeland Security announce any conclusion of that investigation.
You accused these officers of brutal and inappropriate measures. Now that they've been told they will not be criminally charged, will you apologize?
And Peter, there was an investigation into their behavior, so that investigation is playing out. Whenever it's going to be announced, the Department of Homeland Security will announce that. And I'm sure we'll have a comment on it after that. Go ahead.
So because prominent Democrats like the president and his spokesperson lied about Border Patrol agents, now they're going to use the bureaucracy to try to come up with some BS complaint about Border Patrol agents involved here, just so they don't look like, just so Biden and Psaki don't look like liars and morons for what they said. That's apparently what's going on. All right, lawmakers have passed a measure that would increase security for Supreme Court justices following the attempted assassination of Justice Brett Kavanaugh. However, some Democrats voted against the proposal. Why are Democrats turning a blind eye to the left-wing violence that's all over the country these days? Washington Examiner columnist Beckett Adams joins us next to talk about it. Let's talk first about securing your home. You know, recently there was a story about an Arizona real estate agent who found the home she lived in was listed for sale. Problem was, she wasn't selling her home. She was the victim of home title fraud, a devastating crime happening all over the country. According to the experts at Home Title Lock, the crime is incredibly profitable and hard to detect. An identity thief simply creates a fake title transfer for your home and refiles as the new owner. Then he can take out loans on your home or sell it. Typical identity theft services don't cover you, and neither does homeowner's insurance. Home Title Lock does, however. Home Title Lock puts a barrier around your home's title. The instant they detect anyone tampering with it, they help shut it down. Go to HomeTitleLock.com now, and when you protect your home, tell them Buck Sexton sent you for 30 free days of protection. HomeTitleLock.com. Again, that's HomeTitleLock.com. Beckett Adams stops by in a moment. Stay with us. Support for my podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Their products are precision-engineered tools. Manscaped's performance package is the ultimate men's hygiene bundle. Join over 4 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with its exclusive offer for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code BUCK at manscaped.com. The Performance Package 4.0 includes a ton of men's grooming products like the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, the Weed Whacker ear and nose hair trimmer, performance boxer briefs, and a bunch of other great men's hygiene products you never knew you needed, plus a travel bag to hold it all. The lawnmower trimmer is the best. It's got a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents, and it's waterproof, so no more messes on the bathroom floor. You'll also get the waterproof Weed Whacker nose and ear hair trimmer with proprietary skin-safe technology, which helps reduce nicks, snags, and tugs in all those delicate areas. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code BUCK at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code BUCK to unlock your confidence and always use the right tools with Manscaped. In a vote of 396-27, the House of Representatives passed a bill that would expand security protections to family members of Supreme Court justices. The passage comes a week after Nicholas Roski was charged with the attempted murder of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Republicans unanimously voted for the bill, while 27 Democrats, including AOC, voted against it. Democrats increasingly appear to be turning a blind eye toward left-wing violence. Well, they actually always do that, as dozens of pro-life organizations and crisis pregnancy centers have been vandalized and burned in the wake of the leak of the draft decision that we believe could overturn Roe v. Wade. Joining me now is Washington Examiner columnist and the program director of the National Journalism Center, Beckett Adams. Beckett, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So given what we've seen, not just the theoretical risk given the very high pressure around the release of the Supreme Court decision, but the actual arrest for attempted murder of a conservative member of the Supreme Court, why have some members of Congress voted against this? What is their rationale?
The rationale is that they wanted to hold out to extend protections for clerks and family members of people working on the Supreme Court. But again, I think that's a tenuous at best excuse to slow walk this, which they have been doing throughout Congress. And it's even more indefensible given the growing spate of violence against pro-life groups and notable conservative public figures, most notably Brett Kavanaugh of the Supreme Court.
So, I mean, it might be fair to at least bring up the possibility that some Democrats in Congress voted against this and created a fig leaf explanation, if you will, of, oh, we want to extend protection. I mean, no one even knows any of the names of Supreme Court clerks. So that just doesn't seem to me to be serious here. No one thinks that pressuring a Supreme Court clerk is going to change the outcome of a Supreme Court decision.
Right. Look, I don't want to accuse anyone of wrongdoing, but the question I keep coming back to is if they didn't want to slow walk this, what would they be doing differently? It's almost as if there's an implicit sort of blessing on what's been going on. Now, we've seen a lot of acts of intimidation, spray painting, windows smashed at crisis pregnancy centers all throughout the country, at least 13 examples since the draft majority opinion was leaked. But we've also seen examples that cross directly over into domestic terrorism. We've seen crisis pregnancy centers been firebombed. One was razed to the ground. Others were attacked with Molotov cocktails. At some point, the DOJ needs to take this seriously. And again, I go back to I don't want to accuse anyone of wrongdoing or evil or even of ill intent. But if you wanted violence against pro-life groups and conservative public figures, I'm not sure what else you would be doing differently other than looking the other direction. President Joe Biden refuses to condemn it or even really acknowledge the violence. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said there was no need to rush through anything, giving the justices better protections. And again, you saw these 27 Democrats voted against the protections bill. It's almost as if some of these people want the intimidation. I can't prove that. I don't want to go as fully as saying that, but I don't know what else you would be doing differently.
Pro-abortion terrorist group Jane's Revenge has threatened more violence. They put out this statement. We promise to take increasingly drastic measures against oppressive infrastructures. Rest assured that we will, and those measures may not come in the form of something so easily cleaned up as fire and graffiti. From here forward, any anti-choice group who closes their doors and stops operating will no longer be a target. But until you do, it's open season, and we know where your operations are. That is a pro-abortion group threatening violence, isn't it?
That's explicit. And like I said, they've gone well beyond, or some of these activists have gone well beyond. I'm not sure if it's Jane's Revenge specifically. They've gone well beyond graffitiing or even smashing windows. In Buffalo, New York, and in Oregon, and in Wisconsin, there's been actual firebombings, actual acts of terrorism. Now, again, I don't know what the DOJ's reluctance to get involved in. Perhaps they're too busy looking into parents and classifying them as domestic terrorists. But it'd be nice if they looked into actual acts of domestic terrorism right now, especially as the numbers don't seem to be decreasing. And then you have the statement put out where they're very loudly, very clearly saying worse is coming and we're happy to do it.
We actually have a map that shows the locations of attacks on pro-life clinics and crisis pregnancy centers. This does not include churches that have been vandalized. There has obviously not been a lot of national media coverage of these acts of violence, destruction, and political intimidation against pro-life organizations. What do we know about churches that have been vandalized as well? Who's been behind that? Do we have any sense of how much of that has been going on too?
Yeah, there's actually been an uptick in that. Who's behind it is still kind of an open question, but at least five or six Roman Catholics. Roman Catholic churches specifically have been targeted because the Roman Catholic Church in its catechism teaches that abortion is a grave moral evil. Roman Catholic churches have been targeted. There was a very recent example, I believe, from this weekend of three women stormed a Catholic church and stripped down nearly naked and were screaming various slogans, my body, my choice, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have other examples of Catholic churches throughout the country who have been spray painted, the doors smashed in, windows smashed up and all of them left with pro-abortion messages, things amounting to, you know, forced birth is murder and my body, my choice, etc. So this is something that has been targeted. And this, again, not only have we fallen directly into the category of domestic terrorism, but this can, I believe, easily be classified as hate crimes, given that they are specifically targeting a faith.
And just to bring us back to the issue of Kavanaugh and the intimidation that has continued, these protests, there are Democrat voices out there who have pointed out that these protests are explicitly illegal. And yet the Department of Justice under Merrick Garland, there's a federal statute that you cannot intimidate judges in any way, and that includes protesting at their homes during a pending case. This makes perfect sense, right? Otherwise, if somebody wanted to have a mob camp out outside the home of a prosecutor and they were facing criminal charges, everybody would recognize that was obstruction of the justice process and meant to derail that process in some way. So how is it that you think the media continues to get away with not really talking about the fact that there are ongoing protests? In fact, and in addition, actually, let's start with that one. The protests, people act like this is fine. These are illegal protests.
Right, and the White House has gone one further. They have done more than just ignore it or refuse to acknowledge it, but in their capacity from the Brady Room during White House press briefings, they've actually kind of condoned it, saying, no, this is, we encourage people to express themselves. Like, well, no, this is an actual crime. Are you guys going to take this seriously? And I don't think we can miss the irony that these illegal protests have been going on and concurrent at the same time with all the conversations about gun laws and what can we do to make people safer. So you have the White House on one hand talk about how we really need to regulate and we need stricter policy and policing, but at the same time, you have these lawless protests and, frankly, this campaign of intimidation and violence against pro-life groups and notable pro-life public figures, and the White House either remains silent or sort of tacitly endorses it.
And I have to ask you, and I know you're involved in teaching future generations of journalists, Beckett. What would you say to them if they ask you, how is it that there is an arrest for an attempted assassination of a Supreme Court justice, and it's not even on the front cover or even the front five or six pages of the New York Times the next day? What does that tell us?
It's actually a case study that we're going over right now. We talk a lot about bias in media, and some people kind of think that means, you know, there's a conspiracy to cover up stories or to promote certain things. More often than not, the clearest example of bias is seen in editorial judgment. The fact that the New York Times considers the attempted assassination of a sitting Supreme Court justice a below-the-fold story, that says a lot about their priorities and the things that they think are important. It's a cliche to play that if this was someone else game, but I'm going to do it. You know for a fact, if this was Justice Sotomayor, if this was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, this would be a lead story on every network and a front page story in every newspaper. The fact that the major networks either did not even mention it in their nightly newscasts or gave it very quick, brief, you know, discussion, the fact that a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice was targeted for assassination, the fact that they didn't think this was important says a lot about their biases. Either they didn't think it was serious enough or they don't care who the target was. Again, I can't get inside their head and tell you exactly what they're thinking, but their actions do tell you a lot about what they think is important and what they think is, frankly, dangerous, whatever, you know, what is a threat to our core democracy, as they talk about a lot these days, the various threats against our democracy. We saw this actually a lot in 2020 when there was the siege of the courthouse, the federal courthouse in Portland. Media didn't really think that was a big problem. In fact, in the Washington Post, a lot of those writers got a flashy fashion spread talking about the homemade gear that they wore to fight federal troops. If we
were,
yeah,
they
talk
were trying
about
to burn down a federal courthouse, but the media thought that was kind of cute and clever at the time because they're out of their minds. Beckett, unfortunately, we got to leave it there, but definitely come back and talk to us more. Appreciate you being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
With the price of gas hitting record highs on a daily basis, President Biden is now threatening U.S. oil companies with emergency powers if they don't boost their supply output and cut their profits. But is bullying oil companies really going to bring down the price of the pump? Daniel Turner, founder and executive director of Power the Future, has a few thoughts on that. He'll join us after the break. Right now, let's talk about maintaining your digital privacy. A lot of companies promise your privacy is guaranteed, but it's just not true. That's why you need a new privacy and cybersecurity application tool called Secure, spelled S-E-K-U-R. Secure is using proprietary encryption and offering secure instant messaging and email. With Secure, all of your communication is based on servers and data centers hosted in Switzerland without using any of the big tech platforms. Privacy is a big issue now. Without real security, people can read your emails, messages, even your bank information. Secure will never mine your data and never ask for your phone number.
You can send emails to your doctor, banker, lawyer, or anyone else with total confidence you're not being spied on by your internet provider or big tech. Secure is your solution to stop the constant theft of your digital identity. It costs only $5 for the messenger, only $10 for the messenger and email combination package. Go to secure.com and take back your privacy today. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. And use promo code BUCK for 25% off. We'll be right back with more Hold the Line. Earlier today, President Biden called on U.S. oil refiners to produce more gasoline and diesel, saying their profits have tripled during a time of war between Russia and Ukraine as Americans struggle with record high prices at the pump. In a letter to seven oil refiners, Biden said, quote, "There is no question that Vladimir Putin is principally responsible for the intense financial pain the American people and their families are bearing, but the crunch that families are facing deserves immediate action. Your companies need to work with my administration to bring forward concrete, near-term solutions that address the crisis." Biden still blaming Russia, taking no responsibility, of course. No surprise there. Here now with reaction, founder and executive director of Power the Future, Daniel Turner. Daniel, good to see you.
Thanks for having me on, Buck.
Let's just first have you react to what Biden's saying here. So now the price of oil, price of gas, is the fault of the energy company, the gas companies, oil companies, for price gouging? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, Biden has tried to find a foil everywhere, right? He's blamed Putin, he's blamed the oil and gas industry, he's repeatedly blamed COVID and supply chain and all these other boogeymen out there. And that's because he can't admit that his own policies have caused this. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, literally millions of acres of land, have been removed from federal leases for oil and gas exploration, right? Land in Alaska, land off the Gulf Coast. They've taken remarkable amounts of steps in the regulatory space to punish the oil and gas industry. And this is repeatedly sent a signal, right? It's told investors, don't invest in this space because government's not going to allow you to drill. And that's exactly what's happening. The oil and gas industry is not producing at the rate it was, because government is punishing them every step of the way. So Biden wants this to happen. He knew this would happen. He just doesn't want the political fallout, especially as we get close to November.
It does seem that there are some who are aware of what's going on here and the political games being played. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, pointed out that Biden keeps talking about releasing oil from the strategic reserve. That is not even close to being a solution. Watch.
Releasing barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that is not an energy policy, okay? That's a political move trying to CYA so people don't blame you as much, although they do blame him because they're smart. But that's all that is. That is not a solution. And honestly, you have, he's drawing that down. If we did have something else happen, we may need to actually use that for other things, and we may not have the capacity at that point.
Basically saying you really should only use that in a break the glass kind of emergency. Biden's using it in this case to try to take some of the plummeting poll numbers and at least, you know, stop them from continuing in their descent. So what is the Biden energy policy? One part of this I think is so interesting, Dan, is that we're talking about this and Biden says, well, we need to transition to green energy. But then he also says, oh, but I don't have a problem with fossil fuels. Sure. Which is it?
Yeah, there is no consistent energy policy from this administration. You are right. They want to push this green revolution, right? We have this Defense Production Act authorization for solar panels, which is really just a blank check to China. So they want to hasten the transition to wind and solar, despite the fact that it's unreliable, despite the fact that it doesn't really work, that it's incredibly expensive, that it's inefficient, et cetera. They want this to happen. And in order to do that, they have to make fossil fuels the enemy. They have to make fossil fuels get out of the way. And the way you do that is to make them incredibly expensive, right? America loves fossil fuels. But even if they don't have a love for maybe oil companies or coal companies, they love fossil fuels because they love what it provides us. Really inexpensive goods, really inexpensive filling up your car, really inexpensive jumping on a plane to go away for the weekend, right? Our economy is based on reliable, inexpensive, abundant energy, which drives down the prices of all goods. How do we get Americans off of that? Well, you make fossil fuels expensive, and then maybe they will clamor for an alternative. And that alternative is wind, solar, state-run, the green technologies that they're pushing. So this is there, I guess. If there is an energy policy, it's this. Punish fossil fuels and to the point that you break the will of the American people, and then maybe they can usher in this new green technology, because the American people don't want it and the markets certainly don't want it.
It's fascinating to watch how senior administration officials, John Kerry, for instance, who is the climate czar, has gone around more or less saying the answer to the huge spike in oil prices is not more oil production. That's not good. It's now we have to push toward green energy. And you can tell the more politically savvy and honestly connected members of the administration, people that actually might face votes, the Democrats in Congress and Joe Biden himself, are saying, hey, buddy, you might want to settle down a little bit on the let the peasants switch to solar. And even the energy secretary, Jen Granholm, here said that, you know, look, the high price of gas, it's a great opportunity to buy yourself a Tesla. Watch.
You filled up your EV by charging, and you filled up your gas tank with gasoline, and you have the same size tank, you would save $60 per fill up by going electric rather than using gasoline. So it's very compelling case.
Very compelling. What do you make of that compelling case?
I mean, it's remarkable that the solution to a $60 fill-up problem is an $80,000 Tesla, right? I mean, that shows you how Washington, D.C. thinks. And even if you just take the economics of that, what's going to happen to the price of electric vehicles when they become mandated by government, right? The Biden administration wants to force electric vehicles by government fiat, electric vehicles. And that's what they're trying to do. What happened when Obama mandated health insurance? Did prices go up? No, prices almost tripled, right? So that's what's going to happen in the electric vehicle market. It actually is already happening. The price of electric vehicles has gone up, you know, as have the price of wind power, as has the price of solar panels, et cetera. So Biden is just driving spikes in other prices, as well as he's driving the prices in the fossil fuel industry. This all comes from a result of tinkering, right? This comes from the result of people who trust government. They believe in government. Biden believes in government. Kerry believes in government. And they think they are smarter than the free markets. They think they are smarter than the will of the American people. If they just got out of the way, the oil and gas industry would produce more and prices would come down. And wind and solar and electric vehicle prices would come down too. Government here is the problem. Joe Biden is the problem. But he thinks he's the solution. And that's why there is no hope in sight. I hate to say it, Buck.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Dan. Where does this go? Because I'm seeing members of Congress, Democrats, are saying maybe we'll just seize the profits of the oil companies and like redistribute it to people. Biden is saying that the White House is now pushing them to produce more, as if they just have some button that they hit that says, okay, you know, oil production's up 30%, you know, domestically. It's like they have no ideas. So is it just going to get worse?
It is. It's going to get much worse because they don't understand the way the industry works. You're right. They think it's a spigot that you can just, you know, these executives will turn a little dial and more oil will come out of the ground tomorrow. They don't understand the process of upstream, midstream, downstream. Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of the Transportation, frequently confuses the oil industry and the gas companies. And he uses the terms interchangeably, not even understanding that there's a whole mid process of refining and transportation, et cetera. So they're truly out of their league. They don't understand the issues that they are regulating. But notice how that doesn't change the heavy hand with which they regulate. You know, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia next month to beg them to produce more oil. He has sent envoys to Venezuela, to Iran, to get them to produce more oil. Where's the envoy to my industry, right? Where's the invitation to say, look, I want to sit down with oil and gas executives and ask them what we can do? Nope, there's just these mandates that come from the Oval Office, and he thinks that that's how the industry works. So the problem is not going to get better while he is still in power, and sadly, that is still a couple of years.
Good to see you, man. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
As the war in Ukraine continues to grind on, worldwide food shortages and inflation have been a major problem that's only growing worse. So what are we going to do about all this? We'll have more on that and the situation on the ground in Ukraine with senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, Bill Roggio. Stay with us.
It's unclear what the Russians are fighting for, except to advance the whims of Vladimir Putin and the bizarre belief that Ukraine is not a sovereign, independent country and needs to be subsumed somehow into Russia. So I am convinced and confident that at the end of the day, Ukraine's independence, Ukraine's sovereignty will prevail.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying it is unclear what the Russians are fighting for, as Ukraine now says the Kremlin controls about 80% of a fiercely contested city in the east. According to a regional official, Ukrainian forces have been pushed to the industrial outskirts of the city because of the scorched earth methods and heavy artillery the Russians are using. We're going to now talk about what's actually going on in the Russia-Ukraine war and what Putin's intent is with all this. Senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Bill Roggio. Bill, good to see you again.
Great to see you, Buck. Thanks for having me on.
So before we get into one thing I definitely want to talk about today is what the U.S. policy response and all that has really led to and been up to this point. Can you just give us a battlefield update? What is actually happening in this conflict that's getting far less media attention than it was even a month ago?
Yeah, absolutely, Buck. Look, the defense of Kiev was both a military and a propaganda victory for the Ukrainians, but I think it's had the effect of people thinking, well, they won, they stopped the Russian advance, and this one's over. Let's move on to the next thing. Let's move on to the next hashtag, the next Twitter trend, the next TikTok. But the war goes on. The Russians have regrouped. They are fighting according to their doctrine, which they didn't really do around Kiev. And that means bringing up the artillery, massing their forces, and grinding it out. And it's having an effect. Right now, they are advancing against Ukrainians. Ukrainians are saying they're losing 100 to 200 soldiers a day and up to 1,000 wounded per day. These are unsustainable casualties in the medium to long term for the Ukrainians. The Russians have three times more people, three times more soldiers. Sometimes quantity has a quality of its own. And that's what we're seeing in the east. The Russians are looking to take control of that Donbas region. It's the two provinces in the west. But I think they want more. They already control parts of the south. They're looking to break the Ukrainian military. And if the Ukrainians aren't careful, the Russians can break out and advance further west. Look, this war has taken a lot of crazy turns. Everyone thought the Russians, me included, were going to be successful in the beginning. The Ukrainians held. But now the opposite seems to be happening.
So what would it take, from what we know right now, based on Putin's aims and the realities of the military situation on the ground, how could a negotiated settlement work at this point? Or a ceasefire and then some more permanent status? Do we know what that would look like? It feels like the Biden administration never even talks about this as an intermediary.
The Biden administration, yeah, you're absolutely correct, Buck. The Biden administration, their position is the negotiations and what a negotiated settlement will look like is up to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians' position is, we're going to drive the Russians out of the country. We're going to take back the Crimea and take part of those occupied areas that post-2014 the Russians took control of. But that isn't the military reality on the ground. And I don't think that Putin is willing to stop at this point in time. So I don't think negotiations are really even on the table. Neither is looking for a ceasefire, although I do think the Ukrainians would be more likely to take one than the Russians at this point. I don't think you're at that point in this conflict where negotiations will work. And I don't think either side, I think they're years apart, hundreds of miles apart when it comes to negotiations here.
Okay, today, President Biden announced an additional $1 billion to Ukraine. He said, I informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing another billion in security assistance, including additional artillery and coastal defense weapons, as well as ammunition for the artillery and advanced rocket systems. The president also announced an additional $225 million in humanitarian assistance to help people in Ukraine, including by supplying safe drinking water, critical medical supplies, and healthcare, food, shelter, etc. Are we just essentially allowing the Ukrainians to continue to try to hold the line, or is there really any, to the point before about their efforts to kick the Russians out of the country entirely, is that even vaguely realistic?
I don't think at this point in time it's realistic. Look, a month ago, everyone was talking about Ukrainian victory, and I was very skeptical at that point in time. And I remain more so to that. And the weapon systems that we're pouring in actually not pouring in. The problem is they're coming in piecemeal. They're not coming in quick enough. The Ukrainians can't concentrate those weapon systems to have a real effect. It's only having an effect on the margins. It's not halting the Russian advance. So we do at some point have to question, how much money can we keep pouring down this hole in the hopes that the Ukrainians could stop the Russians? Look, I'm all for the Ukrainians holding back the Russians. I'm all for helping them drive out the country. But I'm not sure what the strategy is. And the reality is, and we've been seeing reporting on this, including at the New York Times, that the Biden administration is in the dark about what the actual Ukrainian strategy is. And if they think they have an understanding, what they are seeing, they don't believe it's realistic.
By the way, there's been some Biden administration officials who are now privately, this is reported today, expressing concerns that rather than dissuading the Kremlin with the sanctions the Biden administration put forward, the penalties are exacerbating inflation here, worsening food insecurity around the world, and punishing ordinary Russians more than Putin or his allies. What do you make of that? What's your assessment of that possibility?
Yeah, I think our assessment, or the administration's assessment, on the efficacy of sanctions from the very beginning was unrealistic. They felt that this would be a deal, a devastating blow to the Russian economy. But I think it's had a unifying effect within Russia. The people have rallied behind the government because of these sanctions. It is showing them, the Russian people, that the U.S. is, and the West are against them, and that's helping them support their country. And also, with the rise in oil prices, obviously we all are seeing that, the Russians have more foreign currency reserves today than they had a year ago. It's triple the amount. I believe they're somewhere over $100 billion now. They're making money off this war. They're funding their war. The sanctions did not have the effect. Maybe in the long term, in the medium term, they will hurt the Russians. But today, these are not weapons that have an immediate effect.
It almost sounds like you're saying, Bill, and I just want to be clear, that here we are months into the war that started in January of 2022. We're basically, let's say, 6 months in, and the Russian economy is almost in a better place, or at least pretty status quo compared to where it was?
I mean, the ruble is up. I'm not saying the economy is better. I think there's going to be longer term implications. They're going to have difficulties with imports, but some of this they can work around with China. I would say perhaps it's a push, Buck. It's really difficult to assess this. I do think it will hurt the Russians in ways in the long term. But if I evaluate this today, the sanctions have not had the desired effect.
Have sanctions, just as a point of interest and maybe trivia for the, have sanctions ever had the desired effect? Have we ever seen it do exactly what it was? I know they would say it's a tool, but has the tool worked?
I am very skeptical of sanctions in general. In certain situations, they can be effective. I think sanctions did hurt Iran, at least in the long haul. But the problem is if you don't pursue them, if you don't, you know, if you allow workarounds, this is what we've done with sanctions. And if you just rely on sanctions alone, it's not enough. They don't work always, in those directions.
Always appreciate the perspective. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Buck. Have a great day.
Elon Musk teases which presidential candidate he might support in 2024. We've got that story for you in Quick Hits. Stay with us.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
Governor DeSantis may be getting some support from Elon Musk, and Dr. Fauci tests positive for COVID. Uh-oh, I guess he didn't take the virus seriously. Those stories on tonight's Quick Hits. Let's get to it. First of all, there is a very interesting dynamic playing out here where people like Elon Musk, who voted for Obama and was a Democrat for a long time, have switched over to the Republican side of things, also known as the Not Completely Insane Party. And Governor Ron DeSantis has said something that I think is going to, well, let's just say the lib media is not going to like this one, said something about the fact that Elon Musk, who is the richest man in the world and is in the process of possibly buying the social media platform Twitter, Elon Musk has said that he would support Ron DeSantis in a presidential run for 2024. And here is what the governor of Florida said.
Elon Musk. So what I would say, you know, I'm focused on 2022, but with Elon Musk, what I would say is, you know, I welcome support from African Americans. What can I say?
Elon Musk was born in Africa, and he is now a U.S. citizen. So Ron DeSantis knows exactly how that's going to go over with the lib media. Senator Chuck Schumer. Is one of the most dishonest people in the Senate. I mean, which is saying a lot, because there's a lot of dishonest, slimy liars in the Senate. But here he is on the Second Amendment and just the usual nonsense. Listen.
The Second Amendment gives people the right to keep their arms. Do you think the Constitution should be amended to remove it?
No, I think this. No amendment is absolute. You can't falsely scream fire in a crowded theater. We have anti-pornography laws directed at children.
No amendment is absolute. They say that as though the Second Amendment is not already heavily regulated. There are prohibited possessor laws. There are background checks for over 95% of all sales that actually happen. You can't be in possession of drugs and a firearm. There are gun free. I mean, I could sit here. You could sit here for hours and just go through all the firearms laws. There's tons of restrictions on the Second Amendment that already exist. But yet he goes fire in a crowded theater, which was also, just to remind everybody, Schenck v. United States, a Supreme Court case where the court wrongly decided that somebody who was a socialist, who was against the U.S. getting involved in World War I, was, by handing out anti-war pamphlets, the equivalent of a person yelling fire in a crowded theater. So the fascist here does not even know the fascistic roots of the phrase that he uses. Speaking of fascism, Fauci, he tested positive for COVID today. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is fully vaccinated and twice boosted, that's right, four shots, everybody, is experiencing mild symptoms. He will isolate and continue to work from home and has not recently been in close contact with President Biden or other senior government officials. Oh, okay. Let's just remind everybody here that the vaccine does not stop you from getting COVID. Four vaccines will not stop you from getting COVID. So the whole basis of the vaccine mandate was to prevent people from getting this. And yet that's not what it does. Now it may give you, it does seem to give some degree of limited, but some degree of protection against severe illness and death from the shot for those who are already at high risk. That's a very small category of people overall. And when you look at how you have to keep getting the shot, you have to wonder, what exactly the Democrat plan is here going into the fall. Shot five, shot six, shot seven. Fauci will be there saying, oh, just one more. Senator Cruz, by the way, speaking out on the crime issue, here's what he has to say.
If we want to stop these murders, we know the approach that actually works. The approach that actually works is twofold. Number one, focus on the bad guys. Focus on the criminals. Focus on the felons and fugitives and those with serious mental illness that try to illegally buy firearms, prosecute them, and put them in jail. Get them off the streets. It also means that when people carry out crimes with firearms, prosecute them and lock them up. Make it a priority. You bring a gun to a crime and you are doing hard time. Get the trigger pullers off the streets.
Yeah, Senator Ted Cruz understands that if you focus on the bad guys, if you prosecute them and lock them up, you can actually make us all safer. Everyone becomes safer all across the country. It's not rocket science, folks, but Democrats have been crazy for a while on that stuff, among other things. That's it for tonight's Hold the Line. The No Spin News with Bill O'Reilly is next. Shields high.
We'll be right back.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
Who is there for heroes of the families left behind when a service member or first responder dies or is catastrophically injured in the line of duty? Who helps our country's homeless veterans? And who helps our nation to never forget 9/11? Let me tell you who: the Tunnel to Towers Foundation. The Foundation's Gold Star, Fallen First Responder, Smart Home, and Homeless Veteran programs comprise their In the Line of Duty programs. They're all dedicated to honoring our nation's heroes and their families. The Foundation's Never Forget programs engage people in 9/11 remembrance across America. Over 80 runs, walks, and climbs a year. Dozens of golf outings. And the Tunnel to Towers 9/11 Institute is educating kids kindergarten through 12th grade to help our nation keep its vow to never forget. More than 95 cents of every dollar you donate to Tunnel to Towers goes to its programs. Never forget the sacrifices of our country's greatest heroes. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. If you are an accredited investor, U.S. oil and gas should be part of your investment portfolio. Visit LabradorEnergy.com. Beyond the possibility to invest in a sector that historically delivers sound returns, when you invest with Labrador Energy, you may be able to structure your investment to offset active or passive income. According to many sources, U.S. oil and gas drilling remains one of the best tax-advantaged income investments available. Visit LabradorEnergy.com. You may be able to reduce your tax liability while investing in a sector that has historically delivered sound returns. Learn more at LabradorEnergy.com today.
Offer for accredited investors only. Past performance is no indication of future results. Investing involves risk. Consult your legal, tax, and financial advisors and read the prospectus before making any investment decisions. Visit LabradorEnergy.com for the prospectus and more information.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.